coming up on Starstuff, the most Earth-like planet ever discovered. Astronomers admit they don't fully understand new data they're getting on a distant blazar. And physicists claim they've had their first concrete hint of what they believe to be the particle behind dark matter. All that and more coming up on Starstuff.
This is Starstuff.
The most Earth-like planet yet discovered has been found by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope. The discovery, reported in the journal Science, shows the newly identified world Kepler-62f is likely to be a terrestrial planet about 40% bigger than the Earth and orbiting in the habitable zone of a K-class orange dwarf star some 1,200 light-years away in the constellation Lyra. One of the paper's lead authors, Associate Professor Eric Agol from the University of Washington, says the newly discovered world has a good chance of being a terrestrial planet and potentially having the right surface temperatures to support liquid water, a prerequisite for life as we know it. The planet receives about half as much stellar flux in the form of heat and light as the Earth does and orbits its host star in 267.3 Earth days. It's one of two so-called super-Earths discovered in the five-planet system's habitable zone and one of three super-Earths orbiting the planet. Habitable zones are where orbits are the right distance from a star to potentially allow liquid water to exist on the planet's surface. A super-Earth is a planet greater in mass than our own, but still smaller than the gas and ice giants like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Kepler-62's other habitable zone super-Earth nearby 62e is somewhat bigger than F at 1.61 times Earth's size. It orbits the star in just 122.4 days and gets about 20% more stellar light and heat than the Earth does. The two newly discovered worlds are the smallest exoplanets, that is, planets outside our solar system, yet found in a host star's habitable zone. While the sizes of Kepler-62e and 62f are known, their masses and densities are not. However, all the other planets discovered to date for which scientists can measure a mass have densities that are similar to that of the Earth. And that implies they're rocky terrestrial worlds where there'll be some water in the form of liquid, some water in the form of ice, and also an atmosphere. Based on its size, Agol's best guess is that Kepler-62f is both rocky and with an atmosphere. Earth-sized planets have been found before, but always orbiting far too close to their host stars and consequently much too hot to be habitable. This is the first discovered by Kepler, which is both the right size and at the right location, and that makes it the most Earth-like exoplanet so far found. NASA's Kepler spacecraft, launched back in 2009, has been searching for Earth-like planets orbiting some 170,000 sun-like stars. It does this by staring continuously at a single section of the sky, looking for subtle changes in starlight caused by a planet passing in front of, that is, transiting its star. So far, Kepler's found over 700 exoplanets. According to Agol, Kepler-62f was a late discovery after the Kepler team originally found just three planets in the system.
This initially was identified as a three-planet system, and the Kepler team was going to publication with it last August or so. And last year I've been working on a new technique for searching for transiting planets in the Kepler data, and figured that, well, I'll try it out in this new planet system that they're about to submit for publication. As I did that, I found another planet, which is now known as Kepler-62f, which is potentially the smallest planet, is a good candidate for being able to support surface liquid water.
It's in Kepler's Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. So that discovery ended up holding up the paper because it, you know, it added a fourth planet, and then actually a fifth planet was found, a short period one that's close to the star, that was smaller and therefore missed initially. So now this is a five-planet system, three very close in planets, and then these two further out planets, which are to date the two smallest planets found in the habitable zone of a star. And the one I found in particular I'm excited about because its size is about 40% bigger than the radius of the Earth. And all the other planets that we've found to date for which we can measure the mass have large, high densities. They're similar density to the the Earth. For this planet, we don't have a mass yet because the star is fairly faint and distant, and it makes it hard to measure Doppler shifts of the star due to the planets orbiting it. But nevertheless, we're excited because it looks like this has a good chance of being rocky planet and potentially having the right surface temperatures to support liquid water.
The method you've developed to find these is interesting. Explain that to us.
It was actually fairly straightforward, and I basically just got lucky. So what happened was that the Kepler pipeline software that analyzes the data coming from Kepler found two transits of this planet 62F, and they require three to make it a planet candidate. But the third transit that I found happened to lie near a gap in the data, and the software deweighted that data because it was that the software thought might be corrupted, but my algorithm blithely went along and ignored any such subtleties in the data, and so I managed to identify the three transits and therefore produce a planet candidate that hadn't been identified by this Kepler software.
Now, are you looking for perturbations in the orbits of other planets as well? Is that part of it?
We've searched and we haven't found those for this system yet, which is kind of unfortunate, and so we can only place an upper limit on the masses of these planets based on the mutual perturbations, and we get about the same upper limit that was obtained by Jeff Marcy and collaborators using Doppler shift radial velocity measurements, about 35 Earth masses for the outermost planet, and I guess about the same for the second outer planet, the two in the habitable zone. And so those are uninteresting because we expect the masses to be more like in the 3 to 6 Earth mass range.
That's Associate Professor Eric Agle from the University of Washington. In addition to the two super-Earths located in the habitable zone, Kepler also found three other planets in the Kepler-62 system, all orbit closer into the star than the two habitable zone planets. These planets are Kepler-62b, Kepler-62c, and Kepler-62d. They're 1.31, 0.54, and 1.95 times the size of the Earth, respectively. The star itself, Kepler-62a, is estimated to be about 7 billion years old, about 1.5 times older than the Sun. Meanwhile, a study accepted for publication in Astrophysical Journal suggests that both Kepler-62e and F are water worlds with surfaces completely covered by global oceans. Lead author Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger from the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, together with colleagues, reached that conclusion based on computer modeling, saying the planets are unlike anything in our solar system with endless oceans and no land. Co-author Harvard astronomer Dmitry Sasolov sees Kepler-62e as having a very cloudy sky and being warm and humid all the way to the polar regions. As far as Kepler-62f is concerned, he says it would be somewhat cooler, but still potentially life-friendly. According to Sasolov, the good news is that the two worlds would exhibit very different colours, making any search for signatures of life easier on such planets in the near future. And that's something that may become possible in the near future, following the approval by NASA of a new generation planet-hunting spacecraft to be called the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS for short. University of New South Wales astronomer Dr. Chris Tinney says TESS will build on Kepler's achievements.
One day we'll actually be able to look at these systems. At the moment they're too faint to do much more follow-up than to just find them with Kepler. One day we'll actually be able to look at them with bigger telescopes and hopefully be able to see what the atmospheres of those planets look like.
A lot of people, when they hear about, something in the habitable zone, they automatically think, this is a chance. But then again, when you think about it, I mean, the moon's in the habitable zone of the sun, and certainly no life there, no water on the surface either, at least not in a liquid form. And Venus and Mars aren't too far off.
You're absolutely right. And all of the discussion about whether things are habitable, you have to remember, is based on the one example of a habitable planet that we know of. We know that Venus is essentially uninhabitable because it's too close to the Sun. We know that Mars is also uninhabitable largely because it's too far away from the Sun and too small. So the Moon, yes, is uninhabitable. It's just too small. These planets, though, have sizes that are, one of them is about 40% larger in radius than the Earth, and one of them is about 60% larger in radius than the Earth. So they're at a size where they should be able to retain an atmosphere, and that they're extremely likely to be rocky. But yes, you're right, until we've actually been able to do more follow-up work on these systems, we won't know whether they're actually habitable or not.
You're an exoplanet hunter. Does this give you heart in your work?
It does. I mean, it points the way, I think, to the next generation of planet searches. And indeed, just last week, NASA announced that they're going to go ahead with a new variety of this sort of transit search satellite. That's a satellite that sits above the Earth's atmosphere and looks for the tiny little dimmings that small planets make when they go across the disk of their star. It's called TESS, and unlike Kepler, which is staring at one field continuously.
Yeah, Lyra, yeah.
The Kepler experiment is great, but the stars that it sees are fairly faint, whereas the TESS experiment will look at many more stars, but much brighter ones. And so doing the follow-up work that would be really exciting once you've found a system like this will be possible with TESS, where it's very difficult to impossible with Kepler.
That's Dr. Chris Tinney, a planet hunter at the University of New South Wales. Astronomers say they don't fully understand new data about a distant blazar. Either it's indicating something new about the emission mechanisms of blazars, something different about extragalactic background light, or something unusual about the propagation of gamma-ray photons over cosmic distances. Blazars are what astronomers call quasars, seen directly head-on, and quasars are those powerful energy jets produced by supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies in the early universe. These emit very high-energy gamma-ray jets as they rip apart matter about to fall from the black hole's accretion disk through the event horizon, after which point they disappear forever on their endless journey to the singularity. A report on the pre-press physics blog archive.org and appearing in the Astrophysical Journal Letters claims observations of a blazar called PKS1424+240 shows it to be the most distant known source of very high-energy gamma rays. But its emission spectrum now appears highly unusual in light of the new data. A team of physicists at the University of California, Santa Cruz, used data from the Hubble Space Telescope to set a lower limit for the blazar's redshift, which corresponds to a distance of roughly 7.4 billion light years. A light year is about 10 trillion kilometres, the distance a photon of light travels in a year at 300,000 kilometres per second, which is the speed of light in a vacuum, and the ultimate speed limit of the universe. So, at 7.4 billion light-years, that places this particular blazar more than halfway to the edge of the observable universe. Over such great distances, a substantial portion of the gamma rays should have been absorbed by extragalactic background light. But calculations that account for the expected absorption yield an unexpected emission spectrum from the blazar. Lead author Amy Furness says she's seeing an extraordinarily bright source, which doesn't display the characteristic emissions expected from a very high-energy blazar. Co-author Professor David Williams, also from UC Santa Cruz, says the data indicates very high-energy gamma-ray sources at greater distances than thought. Williams says the data means they're finding things they simply don't entirely understand. Having a source 7.4 billion light-years will allow scientists to better understand how much background absorption there is and test cosmological models that predict the extragalactic background light. Extragalactic background light is the diffuse radiation from all the stars and galaxies, a dim but pervasive glow that fills the universe. When a high-energy gamma-ray photon collides with a lower-energy extragalactic background light photon, they should annihilate and create an electron-positron pair. The farther gamma rays have to travel, the more likely they are to be absorbed by this mechanism. So, this should limit the distance to which sources of very high-energy gamma rays can be detected. Measuring the extragalactic background light is extremely difficult because there are so many bright sources of light in our immediate neighbourhood. In addition to estimates based on cosmological models, astronomers have used galaxy counts to set a lower limit for the extragalactic background light. Using a model close to this lower limit to calculate the expected absorption of very high-energy gamma rays from PKS1424+240, Furness and colleagues derived an intrinsic gamma-ray emission spectrum for this blazar. The results, however, deviated from the expected emissions based on current blazar models, and that's what's causing scientists to scratch their noggins. It means there may be something going on in the emission mechanisms of the blazar that scientists don't fully understand. Of course, there are more exotic explanations. But Williams thinks it may, at this point at least, be a bit too premature to speculate on those. The most prolific star factor in the cosmos, a huge starburst galaxy producing millions of new stars, has been discovered in the early universe. The discovery, reported in the journal Nature, shows the cosmos already had all the ingredients to produce prodigious numbers of stars when the infant universe was just a 16th of its current age. Its discovery is raising questions about existing theories on galaxy formation. The galaxy being scoped in this study is called HFLS3. It's 12.8 billion light-years away, making it the earliest starburst galaxy ever detected, as well as one of the most prolific. It's producing the equivalent of nearly 3,000 suns per year, a rate more than 2,000 times that of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. The study was led by Dr. Dominic Rikers, who at the time was with the California Institute of Technology, and he's now an assistant professor at Cornell. Rikers says there's nothing like this in the nearby universe. In fact, the very closest would have just 10% of this star formation rate. The newly discovered starburst galaxy contains enough stars to make 40 billion suns, and there's a further 100 billion times the sun's mass in molecular gas and dust, undoubtedly the building blocks for future stars. Now, all this is surrounded by enough dark matter to build an entire cluster of galaxies. HFLS3 contains large amounts of molecules such as carbon monoxide, ammonia, hydroxide, and water. Because all the elements of the universe other than hydrogen, deuterium and helium were produced by stars, such a rich and diverse chemical composition is indicative of very active star formation. In fact, the chemical composition of HFLS3 is similar to those of other known starburst galaxies that existed far later in cosmic history. Rikers says the galaxy is proof that very intense bursts of star formation existed just 880 million years after the Big Bang itself.
Well, that was really great. It was a great moment because when we found the candidate, we were suspecting for quite a bit that this might be something special. But it kind of took a lot of effort to actually prove that that's the case because there were other alternatives at the time that could have explained this. So the moment that we really realized that it's that distant and that extreme, we were really excited. So it was really great.
At this stage, is this the most amount of starbursts we've ever seen? Certainly it is from that era. But how does that compare with today, what's happening in the nearby universe, I guess is what I'm asking.
So in the nearby universe, we have really nothing like this. I mean, relative nearby, we have something that's maybe, you know, of order 10% or so, the star formation rate, but there's nothing this extreme. So if you go out to kind of higher redshift or earlier times, you might find things that are similar. But even compared to kind of later cosmic epochs, it's kind of the most extreme that we see. So it's at the higher end of the most extreme starbursts we see even at later times. And the nearby universe has nothing like this.
What does this tell us about the reionization?
So in principle, what it mostly tells us about is a structure formation in the universe, because in order to form a galaxy like this, it has a very high star formation rate. They only can get this very high star formation rate because there's a lot of gas, because this gas is what the stars form out of. And this implies that it's a very massive galaxy. So in principle, what's important is that we need to find some conditions in the early universe that allow for such massive galaxies to form. And this is not trivial early in the universe because we know we start out with a Big Bang. There's no galaxies at that point. Essentially, everything that forms in the universe, all galaxies, all structure that we see in the universe, forms due to gravity. Essentially, the problem in the early universe is that there hasn't been a lot of time yet since the Big Bang. Therefore, the formation of structure due to gravity is not very evolved yet. It's very difficult to form things that are very massive. Simply due to that fact, it gets easier at later times to form massive things. That early on, it's very difficult. And that's why kind of things that are that massive and that extreme are expected to be very rare at early times. They might be less rare at later times, but this early on, they expect to be very rare. So the fact that we find this thing at this high redshift, so this large distance, essentially tells us something about how these things must form and how common they might be at certain times.
And how did it form? Do you think this happened as two galaxies converged?
Yeah, so in principle, that's a second effect. So to get this high star formation rate, you need a starburst. And in principle, most starbursts that we know are triggered by things like major mergers. So you have two massive gas-rich galaxies crashing together, and that's what triggers the high star formation event. This is how we can get to very high star formation rates when we have massive galaxies. Essentially, the fact that we're seeing this thing being that massive means that it must be at a very special point in the universe. because if you kind of imagine these cosmological simulations, right, the cosmic web, you see that there's different regions of different density in the universe. And we know that this must be sitting at one of these knots in the cosmic web where kind of structure can be forming very early on, and we can form massive galaxies early on.
How massive would this galaxy have been?
Essentially, this galaxy, we know from the mass that we observe in the form of gas and stars, is a few times 10 to the 11, so a few hundred billion solar masses. So it's a very massive galaxy at that time.
What were you looking for, and how did you look for it?
So initially how we got to this is through a survey in the infrared. So we used the Herschel Space Telescope, which is operating infrared wavelengths, trying to look for these starburst galaxies at early times. So in principle, we know of the existence of intense starbursts at different points in the universe. And the reason why we look at them in the infrared is because that's where they're brightest. The reason why they're bright there is because galaxies that form a lot of stars and starbursts essentially have a lot of UV light from these stars. However, we know that in the environments where stars form, essentially it's enshrouded in dust and gas because that's the material that stars form out of. So essentially what we're seeing from these galaxies is not the bright UV light from the stars, but essentially this light gets absorbed by the dust that stars are surrounded by. And what we're seeing is the infrared light that gets emitted by the dust. So essentially what happens is that the stars that form newly heat the dust, and then at longer wavelengths the dust re-emits this radiation, and that's in the infrared. And this infrared is what we can pick up with Herschel. And this is why Herschel is well suited to detect these kinds of galaxies, because that's where they're simply brightest. And in principle, in these large Herschel surveys, we have used the Hermes survey. There's tens of thousands of galaxies that are bright in the infrared, many of which are at high redshift. And these galaxies, many of them are brighter, at least similarly bright in terms of flux density as this galaxy. But essentially what made us suspicious is that compared to other galaxies that are that bright and are starbursts at somewhere in the universe, this galaxy looked much redder. And redness in this sense means that the galaxy, there was an indication with this galaxy that it might be much more distant.
Further away.
So this was the initial idea, but we got excited about this as a candidate. And then we did follow-up to confirm that it's indeed more distant than everybody else.
That's Dr. Dominic Rikers, who was at Caltech during the research for this project, and he's now an assistant professor at Cornell University. Physicists claim they may have the first concrete hint of what they believe to be the particle behind dark matter, and therefore nearly a quarter of the universe, the so-called WIMP, or Weakly Interacting Massive Particle. Scientists with the International Super Cryogenic Dark Matter Search Experiment are reporting a WIMP-like signal with a 3 sigma level, indicating a 99.8% chance, or in high energy speak, the first sort of hints of the mysterious substance of dark matter that's believed to hold the cosmos together, but never actually directly observed. In high energy physics, a 3 sigma means you've got a hint of something, 4 sigma means you have some evidence, and 5 sigma, you have a real discovery. So based on that, even though they're 99.8% sure, a discovery still isn't there, at least not yet. Notoriously elusive, WIMPs rarely interact with normal matter, and therefore they're difficult to detect. Scientists believe they occasionally bounce off or scatter like billiard balls from atomic nuclei, leaving behind a small amount of energy capable of being tracked by detectors deep underground. They could also be produced in particle accelerators, such as the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, and they may be detected in space by machines such as the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. The CDMS experiments are located almost a kilometre below the ground, deep in a mine in northern Minnesota. It's managed by the United States Department of Energy's Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory and has been searching for dark matter since 2003. The experiment uses very sophisticated detector technology and advanced analysis techniques to enable cryogenically cooled germanium and silicon targets to search for the rare recoil of dark matter particles. The research, appearing in Physical Review Letters, follows the recent announcement by NASA that a cosmic ray detector aboard the International Space Station may have detected antimatter elementary particles which could have been produced by dark matter. That study, which has also appeared in Physical Review Letters, found an excess of positrons in the cosmic ray flux detected by the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer aboard the International Space Station. The $2.5 billion CERN-built spectrometer is designed to study cosmic rays before they have a chance to interact with the Earth's atmosphere. Cosmic rays are subatomic particles accelerated by extremely high energies by events such as supernovae, the explosion of stars as they die. A lot of them also come from the Sun. The data also showed there was no significant variation over time or incoming direction. So in other words, these weren't point events like gamma ray bursts, stars, or supernovae, but appear to infuse the galaxy equally in all directions. NASA and CERN say their results were consistent with positrons originating from the annihilation of colliding dark matter particles known as neutrinos. The thing about positrons, because they're antimatter, they should annihilate when they come into contact with normal matter. So to have such an imbalance, to have so many positrons coming through, means there must be something really nearby which is producing them. And the one thing we do know about dark matter is that it infuses the entire galaxy. The search for dark matter is one of the most important questions in physics today. Dark matter is thought to make up about 80% of all the matter in the universe, but scientists have never seen dark matter. Scientists only know dark matter exists because when they add up all the mass in all the stars, planets and gas in the galaxy, they find there's not enough mass there to generate the gravity needed to prevent galaxies flying apart due to the centrifugal force of their rotation. Something else, something we now call dark matter, must be there, providing that additional gravity to hold galaxies together. Orbital Sciences' new Antares rocket is successfully blasted off on its first test flight from NASA's Wallops Flight Facility in Virginia.
Point of reference, the space station is 262 miles up north of the Michigan Peninsula at the time of launch.
Four, three,
go Antares.
One.
Have ignition.
Engine start.
Lift off of the Antares A1 test mission from the Mars pad near LA at the Wallops Flight Facility. If you see nominal, attitude nominal. Power is nominal. Engines at 108% and nominal. Attitude nominal. Core pressures are nominal. Altitude 2,000 feet. Plus 30 seconds. DPC nominal. Engines at 104 and nominal.
The privately owned rocket, built in partnership with NASA, will join SpaceX and their Falcon 9 rocket hauling cargo to the International Space Station. The flight from the Atlantic Coast launch pad came after several delays. One on Friday was caused by a premature separation of one of the umbilicals on the rocket's second stage. Strong high-altitude winds also delayed the flight. 10 minutes after launch, the Antares vehicle successfully placed a 3,800-kilogram dummy version of the Cygnus capsule into a 254-kilometer high orbit. Orbital Sciences and SpaceX both hold NASA contracts worth a combined $3.5 billion to fly cargo to the space station. On its next flight, scheduled for late June or early July, another Antares rocket will carry an actual Cygnus capsule on a demonstration mission to the space station. The debut of Orbital Sciences' Antares rocket has been delayed by the construction of its launch facility at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spaceport, located on the southern edge of NASA's Wallops Island Flight Facility. Standing 40 meters tall and developing 740 pounds of thrust at launch, Antares is the largest rocket ever to fly from Wallops Island. As well as the cargo runs using its Antares rocket, Orbital Science has a separate launch contract with NASA to launch a moon probe aboard a Minotaur 5 rocket from Wallops in August. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.